I'm going to go ahead and get started. I'd like to introduce our speaker.
All right.
And it's a very brief introduction.
Yes, brief is good.
Brief is good. This afternoon, we are privileged to have artist Eric Ely here to talk to us about selections from the permanent collection. Eric is primarily a sculptor and actually came to art through working in ceramics. He received his Master of Fine Arts degree from the University of Washington, Seattle in 2005. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. He's shown extensively in solo and group exhibitions in Portland, Seattle, Chicago, and Dallas, and teaches classes at TCU and Richland College in Dallas. Please join me in welcoming Eric Ely.
Thank you. Nice.
Sorry.
You're fine.
Oh, dear.
You don't need to know my background. So, first I should just thank Aaron for inviting me. I always love being at the Modern. This is one of my favorite museums in the country, which is why I'm nervous to speak in it, because standing in the middle of one of your favorite spaces and speaking about artwork makes you nervous. But we're going to talk about five or six different pieces today, and hopefully you guys will talk back. I like disagreement. At least in this context, I like disagreement or agreement. So let's go look at the Anselm Kiefers to start.
Two favorite pieces that I do tours on, but my husband said I'll learn better if I keep my mouth shut.
You don't have to keep your mouth shut. You probably know as much or more about these than I do.
No.
So, my main theme for the talking to you guys today is we're going to connect all these artists through material, or the meaning of material, how material can be biographical meaning, symbolic meaning, or just sort of embody the meaning of the artwork itself. And so we're starting with Kiefer because there's probably no one who works with more symbols in his work contemporarily than Anselm. And I know some of you are docents or have talked about his work, so you can fill in spaces too. So his background is, he started out kind of being well known, he got first known as a performance artist. He did this performance where he would go down around to locations that were occupied by the Nazis, and he would do the Sieg Heil salute and photograph himself. And this was this big piece that he did that got him a lot of attention. And so most of his work is based around German national identity, its history, also its sort of mythological heroic past. And he's very interested in mythology and that heroic past and possibly kind of Germany's heroic future. He's constantly sort of exploring his own identity as a German. He was born at the very end of World War II. So he was raised at a time when, I think, in German educational systems, they did not really speak about what happened during the Nazi system, right? So it sort of makes sense that he would become somewhat obsessed with it. I think that's changed. I've visited Germany a few times. I think there's much more talk about it. But I think for a long time, history books, things like that, didn't address what had happened because they weren't proud of it, right? So it's become kind of the all-encompassing aspect to his work. He uses a lot of mythological references, anything from Nordic to Egyptian to Christian. There's lots and lots of stuff mixed into his work, and his focus has been pretty consistent since he started making paintings and sculptures. This has been his focus for his entire career. So, tell you about my personal relationship with Anselm Kiefer is I love him and I hate him. I think what stuck out to me is every time I come to the museum, I stop here and I look at these pieces. I've been in the museum many times, I come all the time, and I always stop and look at them. So those are the things that I start to ask myself questions about. And what I really respond to in his work is its materiality, right? He uses unusual materials oftentimes. They're called paintings, but there's not really that much paint involved in what he does. It's applied to canvas, but beyond that, there's not a lot to go along with it. I like how physical it is. I feel like there's marks of how it was made. I'm interested in the materials. I'm interested in how crude it is sometimes. And that crudeness is sort of what sucks me in. I I can sort of see in some ways how it was made, or I create my own narrative about how it was made. And that's the kind of thing that brings me into work, is the physical qualities of it. My work is sculpture. My background, I got into art through craft. I thought I was going to be a functional potter. So I was really interested in raw material and moving material around and shaping material and creating space. And Kiefer does a lot of those similar things. So my first gut reaction to it is to that material quality in his work. The way he makes marks, the application is very direct. You feel like you can see how he did it. And then I'm also interested in that it's sort of impermanent. He's this big shot artist who sort of has this mythology around him. He works in the sort of the dense, lush forests of Germany, thinking about mythology and all these sorts of things and building these massive pieces. But he's making these things out of non-sort of traditional art materials that are often falling apart. When you look at it, you can see where stuff is sloughed off the painting, which is why they have this thing in front of it. It's also worth a lot of money, but part of it is because it's so sort of delicate. And, you know, he'll use natural materials. That's an actual sunflower on the front of it. So to keep up his pieces takes a lot of work. So he's working with impermanent materials, and then there's that contrast of it being in a place like this where their whole job is trying to make it continue to survive. So there's that tension between how he makes it and how we sort of want to look at it. But what I also love about it is, like, it's become this precious thing. It's in the middle of a museum, right? But if you look closely, there's multiple footprints on this thing. So when he works on it, it's on the floor. He's standing on it. It's sort of this big heroic sort of piece, but if you inspect it, it's falling apart, and there's footprints on it. So there's a footprint right there. And there's, yeah, it's a little lighter. It's got some streaks. And you can see the heel of the boot over there. And there's another one up there. You can find there's multiple waffle patterns of him just walking across this thing as he makes it. And I like when you notice how, because we make these things very precious in these locations, and that to him it wasn't super precious. He's trying to get something out. He's very physical and active about it. And the fact that there's footprints on it means that he's working on it, not in the way that we see it, but this is on this floor, and he's tipping it up and laying it down. It's in multiple pieces, and it's very active, right? There's lots and lots of layers physically as well as mythologically and sort of his references. So then where I start to not love Kiefer as much is when I start researching him, right? I'm very not narrative in my own work. I'm not a storyteller beyond sort of the narrative of how it was made. Sometimes it's part of the meaning. The materials I use are part of the meaning. But sort of building a myth around my work, I get very skeptical of the myth surrounding artists and their work. And he is so into mythology, and there are so many references in his work that oftentimes when you go to a big exhibition of his, you'll get like a glossary. They'll give you handouts of like how to read Anselm Kiefer's work, which I think for some people is very interesting. They want to see that sort of depth. For me, I want to have a sort of physical relationship with the artwork first, and his material is what sucks me into that. But then as I study him, and I think you should study artists, I don't think everything should just come from the visual. I believe that, you know, what makes something art, I do agree that what makes things art can't be defined only by its visual qualities. It's not like a catalog where you go like, well, that's definitely art. Because you could hang two red squares on the wall and one could be art and one couldn't be art, and it's not because of its physical properties. And we sort of all understand that a little bit. So I like some background, but when I get into his background, it's just so deep. So then I start to have an argument with him in my head, like, why does it have to be all of this into one package? Why can't it be a couple of these things, right? So for me, he sometimes becomes sort of overly dense and obscure, and I think sometimes that starts to make things feel important. If we don't understand it, we think it must be important. But I think he wants to be understood, which I think is interesting about him. It's just there's so much research into sort of what he's looking at that's necessary to fully understand the piece that it starts to become more like work rather than experience. And I like art that's experiential. And so I guess that's what's interesting about him. I experience him, and then I also have to read about him to really sort of get what he's after. And, you know, there are people who sort of like, You said you love Kiefer. These are your two favorite pieces in the whole museum. Is there anyone who just sort of basically, is there anyone who doesn't like Kiefer's work that much? Have anyone thought about it that way? Like, because he's someone who sort of polarizes people in some ways. And critics, you know, there's the critic Arthur Danto, who I like reading. He's very sort of readable. And this is one artist, and he rarely writes negatively about artists. This is one artist he writes negatively about. But what's interesting, he also, I think, has a similar relationship. He wants to love this work. He wants to see it. If there's a Kiefer show in town, I'm going to go see it. So I think maybe that's why he's interesting, and why I like his work, is because I don't walk in and go like, oh, I love him and I love everything he does. I always am having a conversation with what he's doing, and that's what makes him interesting. So I like that I don't love everything that he does, or I don't love all the background, because sometimes it's just very grandiose and he has this myth around him that builds. But what I think is interesting, so like this painting in particular is based on, he works a lot with architecture and the symbolism of architecture. This is based on the Reich Chancellery in Germany that was built during Hitler's reign, and the architect was Albert Speer, which I think is kind of on the wall text. But Albert Speer is interesting in that he sort of kind of accidentally became the head architect for the Nazis, but then started building all these spaces. They would build these huge, these enormous spaces that were supposed to be the most important things, and he'd think about lighting, and sometimes the lighting was because they thought too many of the Nazi head members were too fat, and they had to do things at night and light them in interesting ways so everybody looked regal. So they really thought about these spaces. So he's interested in these huge spaces and the symbolism of the architecture. This was the mosaic room. And that basic converging perspective you see is sort of from a low point in the mosaic room, because there are only images of it left. The building doesn't exist anymore. But what I thought was interesting in relation to Kiefer's work was Albert Speer, when he was building these pieces, they imagined that the Nazi regime would go on for years and years and decades, right? So they thought it would be this fantastic civilization that would go on forever, and so they wanted to think about what their buildings would look like when they decayed. So they came up with this system where it was called ruin value. They wanted to build in a way that they thought when it started to crumble, it would be interesting and significant and be a mark of their civilization. So they thought so far in advance, or thought so much of themselves, that they figured people would want to preserve their crumbled buildings, like the Parthenon or something like that. And so he would build that in. So I thought the idea that the man he's sort of critiquing or having a conversation with historically about sort of the nature of evil and these spaces built for an evil regime, they built in ruin value, and a lot of Kiefer's work is about sort of ruins and ashes. This is covered with ash and mud and things, and he's speaking about sort of rebirth. So they're sort of working with sort of similar ideas about what ruins mean and sort of the myth around them, or myths are built around the ruins and things like that. And for Kiefer, he's speaking about sort of rebirth, this flowers upside down, thinking that like the seeds would fall and sort of replant in the middle of this building, and this building could be taken over by nature. But he also doesn't ever make any small objects that I know of. Like, I don't think I've ever encountered a Kiefer artwork that's not this big, if not much bigger. So there's these strange parallels where I think I'm sure he's aware of it, and talking about that grandiose space of the buildings he's critiquing, or the grandiose ideas of the people he's critiquing, but he's using similar techniques to get you into his work that the Nazis used in their architecture and sort of their rhetoric. So I think it's an interesting conversation that he's conflicted. Like, he's trying to figure out who he is and who his people are and sort of where they're going. And I think the one thing I wanted to note about sort of the materials he uses in here, and that he doesn't really use paint or something. He's an interesting guy in that, like, obviously people ask him about his materials, and he'll say things like, they'll ask him why he doesn't use much color. Like, the color is inherent in the materials he picks. And he'll say something strange like, well, the French historically were the only ones who used that much color in their paintings. And you're like... so sometimes I think he knows there's a myth about him, and he likes sort of making statements that sort of build this myth. that feed into it. So he's just an odd and interesting guy. So I think the thing to just, what I love about this painting when I first approach is I look at it every time. I'm interested in it physically. I'm interested in sort of the narrative of how it's made. Not so much how it's made, but that he is making it. It's a very active way of making paintings, right? So contrasting somewhat with this is his book with wings, and that this, you sort of have to do some research. You have to understand the architecture. Knowing a little bit about the architect makes it more interesting. Knowing about these specific materials allows you to understand it. And then he'll do things like the book with wings in the space behind us that we were talking about at breakfast. Like, I teach sculpture. If one of my intro sculpture students came, I'm sure Margaret would feel the same way, and told me they were going to make a sculpture and they wanted it to be symbolic and they were going to use a book and wings, you'd go like, oh boy, this is going to be not an interesting sculpture, right? It's just like, let's get into those symbols and why you're using them. And so he can swing between sort of very universal symbols and some things that, like, you have to do a lot of research to understand. But what sucks me into that piece also, again, is its materiality. That it is made of, it's rough hewn. You can see how it's made. You can see all of its layers. Every individual piece is laid out. It's not pretty on its, you know, close-up level, on its Lilliputian level, but it's interesting, kind of a beautiful object as it takes up the whole space, right? So the book is a constantly recurring theme with his work. He sees them as a repository of knowledge, of religious symbolism. It's a primary source, which I think is an interesting thing to talk about in the future, you know, like, will books seem more and more precious because it is not our primary? Burning books now does not have, it is symbolic, but it's not actually physically capable of taking away much knowledge anymore because that is held elsewhere. But that idea of the book repeats in his work all the time. Wings repeat in his work all the time. And lead repeats in his work all the time. That sort of has three of his big themes. And what I like about the material choice there is you sort of understand it. Even if you don't know that it is made out of lead, it looks heavy. It looks like metal. And so the wings and the lead refer to Daedalus and Icarus and some German mythology that has a similar flight theory. It also, you'll read about how the lead refers to the god Saturn and that alchemists used to try to turn lead into gold. And that's what I'm talking about, where sometimes when I get into his work, I get laden down a little bit with the symbolism, where when just walking into that space, I just sort of want to be with the piece. I want to sort of physically experience it and let it and how it's made and the shapes it takes on speak to me in a way that sometimes when I start reading about him, I get sort of weighed down with book knowledge, with words, and that I think the piece is successful without all that reading into it. It starts to get closer to things I more relate to, in that the material starts to embody the meaning rather than the material just being a symbol that I have to then read a glossary to understand what that material means to him, because those materials have similar meanings for me. Whereas I don't necessarily understand sometimes all of the German history, or I don't have a personal relationship with it in a way that I sort of physically understand material, one as a sculptor, but also I think just as people, as you understand architectural space. I think it's a beautiful gestural object, and I don't know that complication is necessary for a piece like that, that he needs to add as much. But I also don't know if he's always adding that or if people are writing about that. But he sort of breeds this want to build a myth around him, and I'm much more interested in the things he makes and not in the myth of him as the artist. Also, I think what makes that piece even more successful is the space it's in. I think and we'll talk about one other piece that works in the same way. There's two sort of really distinctive spaces, interior spaces in the museum, and this is one of them, the rotunda. And this piece floating in the middle of it, Tadao Ando, who built the building, he uses very simple materials. You know, this thing is only made of stone, concrete, glass, and some steel, right? And he leaves the marks of how it's made. Even if you don't understand construction, all those little buttonholes in every cement wall is part of the construction of putting it together. He's got very clean, crisp lines. You normally wouldn't go, you know, like aesthetically, if you were at your own house, you wouldn't go, well, I'm going to take some gray object and stick it in the grayest room in the building, right? But it works here because of how it's lit and because it is sort of this lectern, and it's in this space that's sort of ceremonial seeming, or it's made feel that way because of the object in it, and it relates to the building in that they both have marks of how they were made. And that's why I love this building too, is I like that Ando leaves clues to how it's made. He doesn't try to cover it. It's not garish or adorned. It's the material it's made of is its decoration and is its structure and is sort of what makes it an interesting space. And so that's what I respond to most in Kiefer's work, is when he just lets the materials be the meaning rather than be the first word in a long description about history and mythology and things like that. So let's move from the lead of Richard of Anselm Kiefer to the lead of Richard Serra, and who might be the anti-Kiefer, if there is an anti-Kiefer. You haven't asked any questions yet. Thanks. Do you always purposely walk on that so people know that you can walk on it?
Yeah. It just feels fun.
I still occasionally will walk across it when it was in different spaces, and if I didn't notice, and then I just sort of do this jump and then go like, oh, I know I'm supposed to be on this thing.
Yeah, almost every time I come here with her, she always walks on it just.
Yeah, you should. I think that's good, because then somebody will do it when you're not around. They'll be like, you're not supposed to walk on that.
Right. I wish we had it.
I'll stand here a little bit. So I'm guessing most people are familiar with Richard Serra's work, especially his newest work. There's a giant example of it out in front. They're all over the world, mainly outdoor pieces. He rarely does indoor works anymore other than drawings. But I particularly love these pieces, and I remember discovering them when I was a student, because this and the Kiefer are made of the same things but are completely different approaches and sort of really illustrate how material can be different things to different people, not just symbolically but also for embodying meaning. You know, I think Richard Serra would be kind of the anti-Kiefer in that he wants no narrative. He barely even likes the narrative of him being the artist making these things. He wants them sort of very separate from himself. And this is a cool gallery in that, like, we're going to talk about the Serra, we're going to talk about the Linda Bengalis in the corner, but these two pieces are happening at the same time as the Carl Andre, which is the stacked wood pieces, and the Judd, which we see through the door. And they're sort of all happening simultaneously, and they're having conversations with each other, and maybe taking a little bit of good-humored shots at each other at the same time. Right, so minimalism was happening. People like Judd were the superstars, and they were doing everything they could to sort of remove themselves from their work. Not their ideas, but their hand. They had things manufactured by professionals in that field. It was about machine-made things. It wasn't about their own hand. It wasn't about craft. They wanted it to look good, but they wanted the craft of it to disappear and just let the form and the context be what the art was about. And Serra was working at the same time. This is sort of the very beginning of him becoming a well-known artist. And I'm sure most of you have heard of him throwing lead into a corner. That was sort of his first big piece, and it's written about whenever you write about him. He took molten lead, threw it into the corner of a room, let it cool, and then would peel those out as sculptures. So in a way, he's taking a material like lead and metal, lead which we think of as like the most basic, sort of heaviest of the metals, right? It has all these connotations, and turning it almost into a drawing material. He's describing space. He's drawing architecture. And I think you could think of the corner, which is depicted here too, as the basic building block of architecture. Without corners, I suppose you could talk about circles, but without a corner, that's the basic building block of our architecture. So he's starting to draw it with things like metal, right? So these are lead sheets, and this is a rolled up piece of lead, right? I like that he was using materials sort of in an unorthodox manner, in a very different way than Kiefer, but when you experience this, this is just a visceral piece. When you experience it, they've got this line around it, which sort of changes our relationship to it, but is necessary in this context. But the whole of the piece happens essentially right where they all touch, right? That's the sculpture. It's the tension of this thing assumingly being just held by it leaning on itself. So, in a way, the sculpture and the viewer are inhabiting exactly the same space. Whereas, like with someone like Kiefer, with a lot of other art, yes, you're in the same room, but you're sort of standing back, you're trying to understand this thing. The only way to understand this sculpture is to be in the room with it. A picture of it is not the same, not even close to the same, as being in the room, because it is about the tension of holding it up. The lead itself becomes the meaning of the piece. You need nothing else other than your body to understand that. You know, there were previous artists who spoke to similar things, but oftentimes things were welded together. It was illusionary. This isn't an illusion. It's only held up by friction, by what's happening there. Now, would it take a lot to make it move, but we don't, you know, it doesn't seem like it would take a lot. The corners are very embedded into the lead. It feels like if you just tapped it, maybe it would fall over. It would take a lot to make it fall over. But still, friction's the only thing that holds this together. So in some ways, physics is his material. And I like that idea of just the world, the space it's in, the physics of the world we live in, gravity, are the materials he's working with. And again, we don't really actually see his hand in this. There aren't fingerprints, there aren't things like that, but the material is very raw, and you can imagine him rolling up this column. Like, this piece would be quite different if this was just a lead pipe, right? If there wasn't that sort of rolling action, sort of the physical rolling action that allowed it to sort of slump and flatten, it wouldn't quite have the same tension at the apex that it does by being this heavy rolled column of lead. If it looked like a manufactured pipe, I think it would feel very differently. No, well, I think if you had machines, lead's fairly malleable. So, you know, you can move it, but yes, it probably took some help to do so. You could probably softly heat it to roll it up. What's that?
It's a tin one.
Yes. So I think what's interesting about this is that in this simple form, you've got weight, balance, you've got the ideas of permanence and impermanence, you've got gravity being a big part of the sculpture, friction, there's the element of danger, which actually is sort of heightened by the do not cross, you know? It's the moment, it's still versus chaos. Maybe something small could happen and the whole thing changes. And there's strength and fragilities. Lead, weight, this strong material is here, but it's also just standing by friction alone, right? In some ways, this is kind of an anti-statue as well as being kind of the anti-Kiefer, right? It's not about stepping back and trying to learn a history. It embodies all of its meaning. Without being in the room with it, you can read about it, and you can read about his biographical history, but that doesn't really tell you about the piece. The piece is us standing here next to it and experiencing it with our bodies, which is, you know, a haptic experience, which is a word I learned in grad school and then heard a million times and grew to hate, but it describes this thing very well. The haptic experience is about experiencing the world through touch, but it's also experiencing the world adjacent to your body with your body. And I feel like that's how I experience most art when I first see it. I don't try to decode it at first. I see how I relate to it as a human at the height I am, the size I am, and the room that it's in. And then I start to get into what the piece is about. I'm very physical, I'm very analog, and so I respond to the immediacy of a piece like this. It's the idea that to perceive it is to understand it. You don't need someone to describe it to you so much as you just know when you stand next to it what this piece is about. There's not more to it than that. It's just that experience of you relating to the sculpture. So, contemporarily, let's look at Linda Benglis over here. this piece was commissioned specifically for the museum. And Aaron, was it cast in place at the old building? Is that what it was? So it was cast in place at the old building. Obviously, it's moved to the new building. But this is happening at the exact same time Sarah's doing that, at the exact same time Carl Andre's making this, and the exact same time Judd's making that. And this one might seem like the most odd man out, but it's not as odd man out as you might think. Linda Benglis, this is probably her most famous body of work, these poured pieces. It incorporates sort of ideas of abstract expressionism, which was the previous sort of predominant mode with its gestural qualities. It talks about pop art, which was about using sort of low materials, which is interesting to think about because I don't think if you brought kids in art school through, they would think of this as low materials. This is like everything is sort of like this. But at the time, it was very different to use materials like this. And then it's also speaking to minimalism. One material, building a form, right? So this work sort of, and it's titled for Carl Andre, who made that piece, which is the sort of jab that goes into it. But I think it's a... I think it's obviously a pretty good humor jab when you read about why she was doing this stuff. Carl Andre was trying to come up with systems, like those are the exact same size block. How many different ways can I put them together? I'm going to create sculptures that way. And Judd was making the piece across the hall, trying to keep his hand out of it and use industrial processes to build these things. And so she's sort of reacting against that and reacting against the detachment. Again, although her specific hand, there's no fingerprints in this, there's the action of making it. You can imagine someone making it. It's very physical. It's organic. You relate to it with your body. It's obviously not machine-made. Now, I say that with a caveat. Roxy Payne, who made the stainless steel trees outside on the lawn, made a machine that essentially made sculptures that looked just like this. But that wasn't possible until the last 5 or 10 years. So he's then sort of commenting on this, too, as well as new things. But at the time, there was no question that this was sort of handmade, even though there's no direct fingerprint, right? It's different from her contemporary artists that she's giving up some control, right? The material she chooses doesn't allow her to control everything. But it does mean that she needs a lot of knowledge of her material in the same way that these other people do, but she's giving up some control. She's leaving room for chance. It's structured in as much as she comes up with a system on how to make it, but it's unstructured in that she can't control what happens at every layer. She can try, but you're never going to control it completely. In some ways, it's more humble, though I don't think of Linda Benglis as sort of being sort of a humble artist, but just like Judd and Andre were making sort of manly art, and they were seen as like the figureheads and the alpha males of art, and she was a woman reacting to their work and doing interesting things. She also, yeah, you should look at her and look up an ad she did in Art Forum in reaction to these things, which is kind of outside what we're talking about, but she was not afraid to put herself out there and question what was going on with the men in her time. I think what I also respond to in her work is that it has this posture, that sort of humbleness, that posture. It's in the corner, it's sort of slumping, it's falling into the corner. It's frozen, but it feels like it's moving. Again, I sort of relate to it with my body. The narrative comes not from an individual fingerprint of touch, but through the layering. You can build a layer of how this thing was made in your mind, and you see the artist doing this thing. So in some ways, this sculpture is art about art, which sometimes can be doesn't allow you in, but I don't think she falls into that thing. It's art about art and art movements at her time, but it also is not exclusionary or didactic. It sort of welcomes you in by it being so physical and that you sort of can relate. Even if you don't understand the materials or how the materials are mixed or made, this is a motion or a frozen motion that you relate to, right? Go ahead.
Kids are always asking this question. You're saying it's handmade and not used her hands, I am assuming mixed in a bucket or mixed in, and then she just poured it layer by layer?
Yeah, directly into the space it was initially intended to be.
Okay, but it went on layer by layer. And I take it the process, did it dry quickly? Or did
it dries it dries quite quickly. So, and you can find some videos of her online actually doing it, and she'll have some assistance, but you can see that tension in her. She'll be like, no, you know, like trying to call it, like, yes. So it's like, she's hanging on, she's hanging on as much as she can, but she also is obviously, she knows she can't control it completely, and I think that's something that Andre or Judd would never do, right? It was designed to the nth degree or simplified so that that didn't have to be a part of it. You didn't have to worry about that. You know, and I like that it had, that there is that conversation. It's not just digging at it, it's building on it. Like, she's building on Carl Andre, she's building on Donald Judd, while at the same time sort of playfully thumbing her nose in some ways at it too, but she obviously owes a debt to them, and she knows that. She's an interesting artist, smart lady who did a broad range of work. And it's building to the past, it's talking about the past, but it's also looking to the future, material-wise, process-wise, content-wise, at things that these guys weren't working on, but she's using processes and thoughts that they had written extensively about. Donald Judd wrote lots about art, his art, and other people's art, and she's building on that. And so I like her, this piece, because it shows that step from movement to movement. And it's sort of just like it is. It's sort of a frozen moment of speaking about that transition that she and Sarah are making from Donald Judd and the Minimalists, and their rejection of the artist's hand to the artist's hand starting to come back into things, but with new materials, new processes, and that sort of thing.
So what is the material?
It's like a polyurethane foam. So it was being used in industry to make products, but you can just mix it in a bucket and pour it out, and that's what it does.
It's great stuff.
Is it?
What's the name of it?
Great stuff?
Great.
Yeah, it's similar. Yeah, it's similar to the stuff you squirt out of the can.
Yeah, it's just similar to the label. Yeah.
So it's and at the time, you know, no one was. Now every art school kid's, you know, using this for everything, but in 1970 or 69, 70, this was pretty different than what was going on. And then there were other people who were taking it even farther. So she's a really interesting character. She's someone fun. She has a Art 21 video on PBS, so you get to sort of see some of what she's done. And if you search her name, you'll find all sorts of interesting images of her show announcements.
So is she considered post-minimalist because there is a bit of the artist's hand?
Yeah, I would think she was considered post-minimalist, because she was, you know, she was building on it, but she was, and that's, I mean, Sarah originally was considered, I don't know what they would consider him now, but he was a post-minimalist. I don't know if they'd still call him
and
that.
People always talk about
She did big poured pieces on the floor. She's done similar things like this that cantilever off the wall, and then sometimes she'll have them cast into metal, so she's not anti sort of longevity or permanence or that sort of thing. But I also like that this thing doesn't seem permanent either. Like, you can see where some of it sort of broke away, and I think that broke away during the process of making it. But kind of like the kefir, there's a decay built into it that doesn't seem like a forever kind of thing. It'll last a long time because the modern will take good care of it. But she wasn't concerned about forever, I don't think, when she was making these things, which is pretty interesting too. I don't know if more color came in until a few years later, because she does have some that are crazy bright colors. But I don't know at the time if that was available or not. I can't remember the years. I'd have to look it up. But it wasn't long after that she was incorporating pretty garish, kind of crazy colors into the pieces. And she's made glow-in-the-dark ones. As technology has come forward, she utilizes sort of whatever there. She's definitely not afraid to sort of move forward with her materials. All right, let's go around the corner to Martin Puryear, to the ladder. It's time. I feel like I'm going fast, but okay, then we're perfect. Yeah. Thank you. This is your least?
It's just two.
Oh, good. Argue with me. Good, good, good. I like that. That's good. I want to hear why. You have to speak. So, this is Martin Puryear, and it's hard for me to avoid coming to the museum without talking about Martin Puryear, because Martin Puryear was my first sculpture hero. When I started when I was still kind of a functional potter, I remember visiting my friend at art school. I might have been in college at that time, and we went to his friend's house, and laying on the sofa, I remember this dirty college sofa, was a Martin Puryear book. And I flipped it open, and I was like, who is this guy? Like, it sort of changed everything for me. His work talked about a lot of the things I'd learned with a craft background and making, but then moved way beyond the conversations I was having as thinking about function and form and volume. And so he became kind of the impetus for my work to change, and so was kind of my hero and remains one of my heroes. But what I think's interesting to talk about Martin is that when I was reading more about him, I did find a quote that sort of summed up how I approach art, or what was my first love of art, is that this critic, his name is Michael Brenson, said that Puryear has the ability to make sculpture that is known by the body before it is articulated by the mind. And that's not to say that you don't need your mind to understand it, but you approach it with your body first. And that's sort of how I walk through a museum and a gallery. So this piece relates to what we're talking about material-wise, and that, you know, like how it is made and what it is made of is part of why it is made, right? This is a single tree, a single sapling split down the center, and then the rungs are added into it. And what I like about Martin Puryear is that he comes from a similar craft background. That's what I related to. He was a cabinet maker. He learned woodworking in its proper way, in a functional way, and then he discovered along the way that for him skill and craft was not enough. He wanted more. He wanted his work to embody more than that. But he did not want to abandon sort of craft and how you make things, right? So he has a mastery of material. He's obviously, and especially if you have seen any of his other work, he's able to make anything that he wants in wood, but that doesn't keep him from allowing there to be a sense of chance or rawness in the work. He has more than enough skill to refine these things within an inch of their life. And he chooses not to. And he also chooses to leave.